Attention, attention, this is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 63 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This podcast is available in German and English on YouTube, Spotify and Podcast.de, with a social media presence on Blue Sky and Instagram. Note for Spotify users, you can find the latest episodes on Spotify. For all episodes since the beginning, please visit podcast.de and YouTube.
The topic of this episode.
Imagine the German fleet lying idle at anchor. 74 warships immobilized in a lonely bay in northern Scotland. Gulls circle overhead, and below them the cold grave of the North Sea awaits. It is June 21st, 1919. While the fate of the world is being negotiated in Versailles, a solitary decision is made in Scapa Flow. A signal flutters in the wind. Paragraph 11 confirm. It is the order to scuttle. In this episode, we dive to the steel skeletons of the Imperial High Seas Fleet. We talk about honor, despair, and the day the German Navy chose to go down rather than surrender.
Political agenda and background.
None.
The sources that were used.
Book 1, Friedrich Ruge, Scapa Flow 1919, The End of the German Fleet, Gerhard Stalling Verlag, Oldenburg, Hamburg 1969. Ruge is not only an author, but also an eyewitness. At the time he was a young lieutenant in command of a torpedo boat in Scapa Flow. Book 2, Nicolas Volz, And We Rust in the Harbor, Germany, Great Britain and the Naval War, 1914-18, Deutscher Taschenbuchverlag, Munich, 2013. The armistice of November 11, 1918 ended the First World War. Germany was forced to massively disarm and was relegated to a third-rate military power. The Allies placed particular emphasis on the fleet, which had been greatly expanded in the German Empire. The U-boats, which had made life especially difficult for Great Britain during the war, had to be surrendered to the Allies completely and without hope of return. But what should happen to the surface fleet was a matter of debate. The USA ultimately proposed interning it in a port until a decision could be reached. Since no neutral country offered to host the German fleet, it was decided that the fleet should be sailed to Scapa Flow in Scotland and manned by only minimal German crews. This suited the British very well, as it says in Book 2 on page 257.
For the Royal Navy, it was of paramount importance not to have to see the German ships interned in a neutral port, as originally planned, but rather, as Admiral Beatty demanded, to be able to take them into its own custody as a clear demonstration of the superiority of British naval power. The attempt to make the internment of the ships as humiliating as possible for the German side contained the same attempt at retrospective meaning-making as the German plan for the final voyage.
However, transferring the ships was not so simple. It must be remembered that a revolution was underway in Germany in November 1918, triggered by the mutinous sailors. The officers hardly dared to board their ships, and the sailors, simply put, wanted to make a revolution and not make their ships seaworthy and sail into internment. Friedrich Ruge describes what the officers of the time thought of the Red Soldiers' councils. On page 55 of Book 1, he describes what the councils produced as a mixture of self-importance, insolence, fear, detachment from reality, and boundless utopianism. The Allies, however, could do nothing with this. They demanded that the fleet set sail on November 18th, otherwise they threatened to occupy Heligoland and to shell and occupy the port cities. Faced with these threats, the socialist USPD, then part of the revolutionary government, reversed its position and even the soldiers' councils became fearful. In an appeal, they invoked the sailors' sense of duty. They had to fulfill this task now to serve their fatherland and preserve the chance of regaining the fleet after the armistice. The government issued a similarly worded appeal, emphasizing above all that the soldiers' councils had to support the officers and maintain discipline and military order. One can imagine how dire the situation must have been for a government to have to stress this in an appeal. The work could finally begin. Officers and crew managed to get along more or less successfully, and the Allied deadlines were more or less met. The situation was generally better on the smaller ships than on the larger ones, as the crew simply knew each other better and had more contact with each other. Ruge describes the situation of those days on page 60.
On our ships, the torpedo boats, the men willingly pitched in with the work. In contrast, there were particularly chaotic conditions on some of the larger ships. The crews listened to revolutionary speeches instead of working, paraded their red cockades in badges around town, rejected the officers, or made their lives so difficult that they felt compelled to go ashore. Many crew members went home, with or without discharge papers. It was a miracle that the ships were ready for transfer more or less on time.
In the first step, 176 submarines of the Imperial German Navy were handed over to the Allies. For them, it was clear from the outset that the Germans would never get them back. As commander of the High Seas Fleet, Admiral Hipper should have been responsible for leading the ships into internment, however, he refused. Rear Admiral Ludwig von Reuter considered this task necessary for the fatherland and therefore suppressed his personal feelings. A total of 70 German surface ships were transferred immediately, with 4 more following later. Specifically, these were all battleships of the Kaiser, König and Bayern classes, 5 battle cruisers, 8 light cruisers, 50 destroyers or torpedo boats. When the ships arrived at Scapa Flow, they were informed that they would be interned there, not in a neutral port. The welcoming committee consisted of the entire Grand Fleet, 370 combat-ready ships and 90,000 soldiers. Admiral von Reuter protested against the internment in a British port, but was forced to concede. However, this marked the beginning of an impression among the Germans, one that solidified over time. The British demanded the Germans adhere strictly to the terms of internment, while being quite lax with their own obligations. The British initially treated the Germans quite harshly. It's important to understand that it wasn't just the German Navy that was frustrated with the course of the war. The Grand Fleet too had spent most of the war in port rather than seeing combat. And at the one major opportunity for victory, the Battle of Jutland, the Grand Fleet had failed to achieve it. The German officers had the impression that the British were targeting them to overcome an inferiority complex. After anchoring, the ships were inspected. Only a small crew was allowed to remain. 200 men on the battle cruisers, 175 on the battleships, 60 on the cruisers and 20 on the torpedo boats. This was just enough to ensure minimal operational readiness, but certainly no combat readiness. Since the ships were disarmed, however, this wasn't really an issue. Initially, the crews expected only a short internment period. Once again, they hoped to be home by Christmas. It's worth noting that the internment began at the end of November 1918. Very quickly, the British began harassing the Germans in ways that wouldn't normally occur during a standard internment. Mail to Germany was censored. Furthermore, ship-to-ship communication was reduced to the absolute minimum necessary for official duties. Shore leave was also forbidden. The German crews were essentially prisoners on their own ships. While there might have been some room to move around on battleships, this was definitely not the case on the torpedo boats. In addition, the crew's provisions had to be delivered by transport ship from Germany. However, due to the ongoing naval blockade, this proved difficult, and there was widespread malnutrition on board. The suggestion to purchase food from Great Britain was rejected. The isolation quickly led to boredom, especially during the long dark winter and due to the bleak surroundings. Furthermore, because the German ships couldn't run their main boilers continuously due to fuel shortages, it quickly became very cold on board and electricity became scarce. Here too, the British were of no help. The German officers were constantly worried that the British would seize the ships prematurely and therefore tried to act as cautiously and reservedly as possible. The hope was that at least a few of the ships could be returned to Germany. The sailors' councils proved unhelpful in this regard. While they were gradually being pushed back in Germany, the atmosphere on the ships remained virtually frozen at the level of November 1918 and persisted throughout the entire internment. Admiral von Reuter endeavored to send the most difficult sailors back to Germany one by one in order to regain control of the ships. Nevertheless, he was forced to transfer to the light cruiser Emden after the situation on the battleship Friedrich der Große became unbearable for him personally. Clandestine radio signals between the soldiers' councils and some groups in Germany ultimately led the British to remove the radios from the German ships. The only remaining connection to the outside world was now several days old English newspapers, which the crews received regularly. And there they read things like this article from the Globe newspaper, reprinted in Book 2 on page 257. "The German Navy is not only defeated, but forever disgraced, as much by its depravity in combat as by its cowardice on the day of its downfall." Articles like this shaped the mood among the officers and their expectations of the British. Service on board during internment was limited to half days. The rest of the time was filled as far as possible with voluntary work and afternoon and evening classes, such as English, geography, mathematics, chemistry, and so on. All the books on the ships were used for this purpose. Reading, writing, music, and other pastimes were also very popular. Medical care was rather poor. There was no dentist, and since malnutrition led to scurvy and increased dental problems, the Germans would have been dependent on British assistance in this area as well. However, the British did not provide any help. Those suffering from dental problems endured it as long as they could, but many simply couldn't bear it after a while and had to return to Germany. All of this led to a steady reduction in crew numbers, and the ships slowly transformed into ghost ships. The Germans got along better with the English civilians who piloted the supply boats, and a certain amount of bartering began. What exactly did these supplies consist of? Friedrich Ruge lists the sailors' daily and monthly rations as follows. Daily, 140 grams fresh meat or 100 grams of canned meat, 30 grams bacon or sausage, 30 grams butter or fat, a portion of which had to be given to the galley, 20 grams of sugar, 600 grams of bread. Monthly, 1 kilograms of legumes, 1.6 kilograms flour or pasta. On pages 92-93, he elaborates further. "These were all maximum quotas, and they were by no means always met. For example, one shipment was missing all its fresh meat, another one was missing 3,600 loaves of bread and 15 tons of potatoes. Only beet jam, pearl barley, and dried vegetables were plentiful. These could be used as a dish, as a tea-like beverage, or to extend pipe tobacco. Pearl barley, which was served 3 times a week, and beet jam went quite well together. Supplies of tobacco products and canteen items, meaning things that could be purchased, were also very scarce. The entire list of items that the Wilhelmshaven Food Supply Office was able to deliver in February consisted of soup seasoning, salt, jars of gherkins, jars of pickles, canned fruit, wine, cigars, and cigarettes." Fishing helped to improve provisions somewhat for a while. However, the sailors were dependent on bartering, especially for tobacco products and soap. From February onward, soap was no longer available from Germany at all. Rat and cockroach infestations quickly broke out on the ghost ships, which the crews had to fight. Their efforts, however, were largely unsuccessful. The sailors learned about the peace terms and the progress of the negotiations with a delay of several days through the newspapers. The peace conference, however, lasted much longer than expected. It only began in January 1919, and it wasn't until the beginning of May that the final peace terms appeared in the newspapers. The terms were worse than anything the Germans had feared. For the Navy in particular, the conditions would have relegated Germany to a third-rate naval power. On page 131, Friedrich Ruge writes, "One thing had been achieved.
There was complete clarity about the spirit of this treaty and the fate of the fleet. No more hope of bringing even a single boat home.
France and Italy, which had focused on their armies during the war, were particularly interested in acquiring German warships, despite the anticipated logistical difficulties of operating them. The USA and especially Great Britain were less enthusiastic about the idea. The USA didn't want to see global naval power grow further, and Great Britain didn't want its naval advantage diminished. The dispute over the ships caused considerable friction among the Allies. The German government initially refused to sign the treaty, but here too the Allies' message was unequivocal. Friedrich Ruge writes on pages 132-133,
"If the German government did not sign the treaty, then a state of war would be reinstated. The Allies would occupy further parts of Germany, and the armistice would no longer be valid. The ships in Scapa Flow could neither fight nor break out. The only option left to us, should hostilities resume, was to attempt to scuttle the ships."
That the ships had to be scuttled when hostilities resumed, as they could under no circumstances be allowed to fall into enemy hands, was perfectly clear to the officers. Much time has been devoted among historians to clarify whether and when Admiral von Reuter received the order to scuttle the ships. However, according to the ethos of naval officers at the time, such an order was not even necessary. That the ships had to be scuttled was as self-evident as saluting a superior officer. Admiral von Reuter made it clear in his order under what circumstances the scuttling should take place and whom he would blame, as printed by Friedrich Ruge on page 210.
"It is my intention to scuttle the ships only if the enemy should attempt to take possession of them without the consent of our government. Should our government agree to the surrender of our ships in the peace negotiations, then the ships will be handed over to the lasting shame of those who have brought us into this situation."
And in Book 2 on page 263 it says,
"Admiral Reuter was a level-headed Prussian officer who could easily deduce that the British weren't going to such great lengths to stage the internment of the German ships as a humiliating spectacle, only to let them steam back home unscathed a short time later."
Without explosives, scuttling was only possible by opening valves and destroying pipes carrying seawater. Preparations were difficult because in the end there was hardly any crew left, and the Germans constantly expected to be occupied by the British. It proved to be a disadvantage that the British had virtually severed all contact between the Germans and their homeland, only informing them sporadically through outdated newspapers. In the end, there were only 75 men left on a battlecruiser, 50 on a battleship, and 20 on a cruiser. The situation escalated in mid-June. On page 144, Friedrich Ruge writes,
"For us, the situation was determined by the unambiguous pronouncements of the English press, all of which were in the same tone as an article in the Times from June 17, 1919, dated one day earlier. This article began, 'In 5 days from today, Germany will have accepted the terms, or the Allied and Associated Powers will resume the war with arms. The armistice has already been terminated under certain conditions. It will expire on June 21st if the peace treaty is not signed.' That was clear enough. For us it meant, at noon on June 21st, war would resume."
According to Ruge, he, but not Admiral von Reuter, was informed by an Englishman passing by shortly before the scuttling that the deadline had been extended to June 23rd. This was supposedly also reported in one of the newspapers. However, trust in the British had by then reached zero, and the Germans feared that the British would strike first, leaving them no chance to scuttle their ships. Moreover, there had been no confirmation from Germany, so this could have been propaganda. Surprisingly, on June 21st, the British watch crew sailed into the North Sea for gunnery practice. At noon, Admiral von Reuter gave the signal to scuttle the ships, the Imperial war flag was hoisted one last time, and the crew scuttled their vessels as planned. Afterward, they boarded the lifeboats and headed for land for the first time. The few remaining British sailors tried to drive the Germans back to their ships to stop the scuttling. Shots were fired, resulting in 9 German deaths and 21 wounded. The Germans were eventually taken prisoner. Their treatment ranged from civilized and proper, as on the battleships Sandhurst and Victorious, to threatened executions with firing squads already assembled, as on the ship Spencer. Reading Friedrich Ruge's book, one can't help but get the impression that the high-ranking English officers in particular had expected nothing less from the Germans. On board the Resolution, the captain read out an official statement from the British Navy accusing the Germans of treason. A German lieutenant commander rejected this accusation. The English captain smiled crookedly and simply replied that he had orders to read the message. And that was that. The German crews were treated as prisoners of war, even though taking prisoners of war after armistices isn't allowed, but who cared about that? After a good 6 months in prisoner of war camps with fellow soldiers, the sailors were only allowed to return to Germany in January 1920, after Germany had ratified the Treaty of Versailles. International reactions were mixed. In Germany, the action was both celebrated and condemned. While there was relief that the ships had not fallen into Allied hands, Admiral von Reuter was also accused of risking the resumption of hostilities. Upon his return, however, Admiral von Reuter was promoted to Vice Admiral by order of Reich President Friedrich Ebert. The Allied governments were unanimously outraged and spoke of a betrayal of the spirit of the peace agreement. The French and Italians in particular were disappointed as they had hoped to receive some of the ships. The British Navy, on the other hand, was ashamed that this had happened under its watch. But was that really the case? In Nicolas Wolz's book, it is stated that Reuter was likely aware of the extension of the deadline, and the British probably also knew what the Germans were planning. The firing exercises allowed the Germans to carry out the scuttling, and the British no longer had to distribute warships to other countries. Higher-ranking British officers also stated that they had expected nothing less from the Germans. How exactly did the scuttling unfold? The scuttling signal was given at 11:20 a.m. local time. It took some time for the effect to become visible. After about half an hour, the ships began to visibly sink or list. At this point, the German crews began abandoning their ships. It wasn't until 2:30 p.m. that the British naval units guarding the German fleet reached the harbor and initiated countermeasures. However, their efforts came too late. Only the large ships were still afloat, and of these only the battleship Baden could be saved. In the end, 15 of the 16 battleships and battlecruisers, 5 of the 8 cruisers and 32 of the 50 destroyers had sunk. The remainder were mostly grounded and thus at least partially damaged. The cost of salvage was deemed too high, so the sunken ships were initially ignored. The damaged ships were repaired and distributed among Allied fleets, but since these were only small and medium-sized vessels, the effect on the overall strength of the fleets was negligible. Over the following decades, most of the ships were salvaged and scrapped. A total of 7 wrecks still lie in Scapa Flow. The battleship Baden was the only capital ship the British were able to save. It belonged to the Bayern class and was thus one of the most modern German ships. The Baden was repaired as early as July 1919 and subsequently thoroughly examined by the Royal Navy. However, the ship was not commissioned into Royal Navy service, but used as a target ship and was sunk in August 1921. The Baden demonstrated the ineffectiveness of medium armor, which contributed to the introduction of the all-or-nothing armor strategy on British battleships. The cruiser Emden was transferred to the French fleet, but was so badly damaged that it could no longer be used in combat. The ship was used for weapons testing and scrapped in 1926. The cruiser Frankfurt was transferred to the US Navy. In 1921, it was sunk by aerial bombs while being used as a target ship. The cruiser Nürnberg was transferred to the British Navy and sunk as a target ship in 1922. The destroyers that could be salvaged were handed over to the USA, Great Britain, France, and Japan. However, not a single ship remained in service for long. Most were sunk as target ships in 1921-22. With the scrapping of the cruiser Emden and one destroyer in 1926, not a single ship of the high seas fleet remained in service anywhere in any capacity. The German navy was subsequently decimated a second time. The Allies had originally intended to leave the German Reich some modern ships as the foundation for a post-war navy, but after the scuttling of the German navy at Scapa Flow, the remainder of the German navy was further reduced. In addition to surrendering all remaining reasonably modern ships, port facilities also had to be ceded. The German navy was left with only the following vessels: 6 pre-dreadnoughts of the Deutschland and Braunschweig classes, 6 old light cruisers, 12 destroyers, and 12 torpedo boats. The maximum strength of the navy was set at 15,000 men. There were also strict regulations regarding the construction and replacement of ships. More on that in a future episode. The battleships König, Kronprinz Wilhelm, and Markgraf, the cruisers Brummer, Köln, Dresden, and Karlsruhe, as well as parts of the destroyer S-54, remain at sea in Scapa Flow to this day. They are virtually all that remains of the Imperial German Navy.
A few finishing words.
Today, the wrecks of Scapa Flow are a diver's paradise and a memorial of steel and rust. They lie there preserved in the salt water while time has simply moved on above them. Perhaps that is the most important lesson of this story. You can sink ships, but you cannot undo the events that led them there. They remain part of our history, sometimes on the surface, sometimes buried deep on the seabed.
Thank you! This was History Lost in Time.